You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Robert Reich joins us now to discuss the economics of poverty on this week's edition of our series Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America. We will look into whether raising the minimum wage will lift people out of poverty and talk about growing income inequality and how changes to the middle class are connected to poverty. Professor Reich, who was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, is currently Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. He's written 13 books. I'm sorry. His latest is Beyond Outrage, which was the basis of a documentary called Inequality for All. Welcome back to our show.
Hello, Leonard.
Income inequality has always been part of society. Why has it become a concern in America today?
Because it's getting out of control. We have not seen levels of inequality this extreme since, by some measures, the 1920s, by other measures, the 1880s. But whichever measure you use, we are seeing a larger and larger portion of the nation's income and wealth going to a smaller and smaller number of people at the very top.
Well, how much inequality has been considered normal for a country like ours?
We assumed, was the kind of inequality we had between the Second World War and, let's say, 1980, 1990, when many of today's adults and today's leaders had their formative years. Those, actually, in retrospect, those years proved to be something of an anomaly. We saw during those years that the top 1%, the richest 1% of Americans, took home roughly 10% of total income. Now it's up to over 20%.
Is inequality a sign of a troubled economy?
Well, it could lead to economic trouble, Leonard, because if the rich take home most of the nation's income and wealth, the vast middle class and poor don't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going. And I believe that one reason that this recovery, so-called recovery, is really so slow, in fact, one of the most anemic recoveries on record, is that the middle class and poor simply are not earning enough to turn around and buy what the economy is capable of producing.
So there's a finite amount of money, and if the wealthiest 1% have more of it, that means that there's less left for everyone else?
Well, there's not a finite amount of money, but given productivity improvements, we had seen for years median wages, which is a pretty good indication of where most people are because the median wage is right smack in the middle, median wages rise with productivity. Beginning in the late 70s and continuing on even till today, that median wage, adjusted for inflation, has remained fairly stagnant. That is, the buying power of most people has not really increased very much, even though productivity continues to grow. So the amount of goods and services we have in the economy that we can produce at or near full employment keeps on rising. And I'm not only talking about stuff, you know, the kind of stuff that people stuff in their homes. I'm talking about everything that includes health care, education, public health, many public goods. We can, because rising productivity, we can do better and better. And each employer and each employee can produce more and more, but because wages have stagnated for most people, they really are unable to afford what we can produce at or near full employment.
Are the poor getting poorer, just remaining stuck in poverty while the middle class is shrinking?
Well, the poor are, by some measures, getting poorer. It's hard to talk about this without getting wonky, and I don't want to get wonky.
Oh, why not?
I don't. Well, I'll get a little wonky. You see, certain goods and services have become much cheaper. As technology has progressed, as productivity has improved, the cost of some, like television sets, much cheaper in terms of the percentage of a typical wage that is spent on television, buying television sets, for example, than they were television sets 30 years ago. Other things have become much more expensive. relative to the typical wage. Healthcare, education, particularly higher education, many rents and home prices in many metropolitan areas have also increased faster than most people's wages.
And gas prices, for example.
I'm sorry?
Gas prices. A lot of people still have to rely on a car, even if they're poor.
Yes, gas prices and even most cars are rising. The prices have risen faster than the typical paycheck for most people. So of that typical paycheck, more is paid for health care, for education, for gas, for a lot of the things that I've just mentioned than used to be the case. Now, what we try to do in terms of adjust for inflation and adjust for purchasing power is to say, well, in today's dollars or in dollars that were 30 years ago, how are today's workers doing? If they are in the median, that is, they're 50% above, 50% below them, or if they are considered to be poor, according to the government's measure of poverty. And we see that most people, as I said, are not doing much better than they did before. People in the bottom half, many of them are doing worse than they did before. People who are poor, that is, who are earning under about $22,000 a year, they are worse off in many respects. Our measure of poverty doesn't take account of many of the rising prices that you and I have just talked about.
Many of the people we've spoken to for this series that taking a look at poverty have pointed out that poverty is growing in the suburbs and that most people living in poverty are working people. What do you think that says about the economy?
Well, it says very much what I've been talking about, and that is that wages are not keeping up for most people. And if you are working but earning a minimum wage or earning close to the minimum wage, you are not going to be able to get yourself and your family out of poverty. We have a larger percentage of working poor in the workforce today than we did 30 or 40 years ago. The poverty rate, which is about 15% of our total population, hasn't changed very much over the past 30 or 40 years, but more of those people are actually working.
President Obama has called for the minimum wage to be raised to $10.10 by 2016, up from the current $7.25 an hour. How has the minimum wage been determined, and why do we even have a minimum wage law in this country?
We decided in 1938 that we should have a minimum wage, and I think it was partly because of the Depression. People were not earning very much at all, if they were even in jobs. And the thought, the dominant thinking of that era was that if you put money in people's pockets, more money, then they can turn around and buy stuff, and that will help get the economy going and create jobs. There was also a moral argument that we have to have a kind of minimum standard of decency in this country. And if people are going to work, they should at least, if not get out of poverty, they should earn something that we would consider, most of us consider, to be minimally decent. That was the logic behind the 1938 law. Now, we have increased the minimum wage, adjusted for inflation, up to about 1968. 68 was the high water point. If we had continued with the minimum wage we had in 1968, and adjusted it for inflation so that the buying power of the minimum wage worker was exactly what it was in 1968, today's minimum wage would be above $10 an hour. If we went further, Leonard, and we adjusted for the productivity increases that I mentioned to you before, that is, most workers are producing and their output is much greater than it was 30 or 40 years ago, then the minimum wage would probably be closer to $15 an hour today.
Now, there's always been resistance to raising it, like it was when you proposed raising the minimum wage during the Clinton administration. So we hear those arguments for and against a lot, but maybe we should talk about them. Some economists say that raising the minimum wage will be bad for the economy. It'll hurt small businesses and job creators.
Well, there have been a number of studies, and, you know, there are always, with economics and economic studies on both sides of whatever issue you want to talk about, but the predominant studies, the studies that are most sophisticated, tend to show that moderate increases in the minimum wage do not result in job losses for a number of reasons. One reason, and I think the major reason, is that when people, as I said, have more money in their pockets, they can turn around and buy more. Minimum wage workers will spend every dollar they get because they are paid so little. And that spending has an effect on the economy. That generates more jobs. More spending is good for the economy in terms of job creation. And so that any negative employment effect that might be felt in terms of a particular employer who says, I don't want to pay my employees more, it's better for me to have fewer employees, I'm going to substitute foreign workers, or I'm going to substitute technology, is made up for in terms of the numbers of new jobs being stimulated by the remaining workers who have higher wages. That's argument number one.
Well, some critics of raising the minimum wage say that it's mostly young people, teenagers, who work minimum wage jobs and not people who support a family.
That used to be the case, but new evidence shows that most minimum wage workers today are actually major breadwinners for their families. So if the teenage argument held any water in the 1990s, 1980s, it doesn't today. When I was Secretary of Labor back in the 1990s and we had a big debate over raising the minimum wage, I heard many of the same arguments. We mustn't raise it. And I and others gave many of the same arguments back, that raising the minimum wage is not going to generate job losses because it will actually generate more sales, and also that many of these people are major breadwinners, although at that point in time, only about 40% of minimum wage workers were major breadwinners. Today, it's up to about 65%. I should also add, Leonard, that in 1996, when we raised the minimum wage, not only were there not job losses, but the following 4 years registered the highest job gains, 4 years running, that we've ever had in this country. I'm not saying that raising the minimum wage was responsible for that. I'm just saying that what happens in an economy is that minimum wage increases are so small relative to other cross currents in the economy that they really tend not to either generate job losses or job gains. They tend to, the noise gets canceled out.
Well, many people have also asked if $10.10 is adequate. Does that rate keep up with inflation and the cost of living? Some proponents of raising the minimum wage say that right now taxpayers subsidize workers who earn the minimum wage because low-wage workers end up using food stamps, Medicaid, other social welfare programs. Would the government save a bit of money if we raise the minimum wage?
Well, there is evidence that the bill for Medicaid, for housing assistance, for food stamps would be reduced if we raised the minimum wage more than $10.10 so that we had fewer people in poverty, so that it was closer to a living wage. And indeed, I do believe that we should raise the minimum wage over 3 or 4 years to $15 an hour.
Which San Francisco is doing, and there's been a huge outcry there.
Seattle is just about to do it, and of course there's an outcry. I mean, many of small businesses, just as they, in every time the minimum wage is raised, they say no, terrible things are going to happen, and then it turns out terrible things don't happen. You know, there was a study. There have been a number of studies. Some of my colleagues here at Berkeley, also Alan Krueger and David Card, years ago, they study what happens in fast food restaurants to the number of jobs, comparing fast food restaurants in states where minimum wages are increased, because certain states and cities have an allowance. They are permitted by federal law to raise their minimum wage higher than the federal minimum. Relative to other states and localities close by, where the minimum wage is still at the federal level. And what they've seen, even though many of these studies look at small businesses that are located almost next to each other, there's just a state line between them or a jurisdictional line between them, separating certain counties. What they find is that there is no appreciable effect, negative employment effect, from raising the minimum wage. If anything, there is a positive employment effect.
My guest is Robert Reich, who is currently Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. We're talking to him as part of our series, Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Our guest on today's segment of Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America, is the Secretary of Labor of the Clinton administration, Robert Reich, who's currently Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. And Professor Reich, a listener asks, if wages are not going up, why are prices going up?
Prices are going up because companies that cannot essentially make more money by selling more of their products in an environment where the middle class and the poor don't have more money in their wallets to pay for more products and services, those companies are going to do everything they can to raise prices. If they are in a less competitive environment, such as the internet, I mean, broadband is very uncompetitive. There's almost no competition. Then broadband providers will continue to raise their prices as high as they can. That's why competition and antitrust laws that enforce competition are so vitally important.
What about the quality of most low-wage jobs? Do they tend not to have much job security or benefits like health care and paid sick leave?
Absolutely. They tend to have no security attached to them, and they don't have benefits. What we know, for example, the largest employer in the United States is Walmart. Walmart's typical wage, if you include all the part-time workers, is $8.80 an hour, and most of those workers do not have health care benefits. Again, I'm including the part-timers, and Walmart has a lot of part-time workers. Contrast this, Leonard, to 40 years ago when the largest employer in the United States was General Motors, whose workers, if you examine in today's dollars, that is, you adjust for inflation, in today's dollars would be making $35 an hour, not $8.80 an hour, and also receiving health benefits and pension benefits. So there's been a huge change in what's happened to American workers.
The Walton family is, they're among the richest people in the world. I just read about the salaries of some of the heads of fast food chains. They make a lot of money. Why do you think there's resistance to paying their workers a little more? Do they need all the money themselves to open up art galleries in places that nobody can get to?
Well, obviously, CEOs today who are earning on average $250 to $300 times what their workers are earning don't actually, quote unquote, need that money. I mean, if we were talking about need, I mean, how can anybody need tens or $20 million a year? We have hedge fund managers earning $1 billion a year, which comes to something like over $1 million an hour. I mean, we're talking, it boggles the mind, actually. If you think of a hedge fund manager earning almost $1.5 million or $2 million an hour, and we can't raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour, because why? Because of ideology. We have this notion in this country that everybody is paid what they're worth. But you examine how it is that CEOs get paid, why they're being paid now 300 times the typical worker when they were paid 40 years ago 30 times the typical worker. And you see, it's not the market. It's not that everybody is paid according to what they're worth. It's just that CEOs appoint the compensation committees on their boards. Many of those compensation committees don't want to be seen as awarding their CEOs less than their competitor CEOs. So it has a ratchet up effect. Meanwhile, you've got these hedge fund managers and private equity managers who have a lock, essentially a lock on their markets. I mean, you've got huge institutional investors who are investing in a handful of these major hedge funds and private equity funds, and they also get tax advantages because of their political power. Meanwhile, it used to be that ordinary workers had unions behind them to bargain on their behalf to get a portion of the benefits of all of the profits that they were generating from their labors. But labor unions have dried up. Labor unions in the private sector represented more than a third of all workers 40 years ago. Today, labor unions represent fewer than 7% of workers. So this ideology that we're paid what we are worth doesn't take any account of these institutional and political and bargaining factors, which are so central to setting wages.
Haven't some Scandinavian countries have laws that limit the percentage that the wealthiest can make in relation to the people at the bottom?
Well, they do have those laws. They also have tax systems that are far more progressive.
Do those countries suffer as a result?
They don't seem to. I mean, even the United States, though. I mean, look at the United States between the Second World War and, let's say, 1981, where we had very high taxes on the highest income earners, over 70% marginal income tax, and we had the top income earners earning, the CEOs earning 30 or 35 times more than the average worker. Well, it turns out that in those years, we grew an average faster than we have grown on yearly averages since 1981, when taxes on the top dropped dramatically and when CEOs started to earn not just 25 or 30 times their average worker, but 250 to 300 times the average worker. So there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that these extravagant salaries and take-home pays have helped the economy.
You see, this is just an ideological issue?
I think it's largely ideological. I mean, it's ideology in the service of greed.
My guest is Robert Reich, who is Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. We're talking to him on today's segment of our series, Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America, about the minimum wage and related matters. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener, Anne from Beacon, New York, asks, if we succeed in raising the minimum wage, do you think that it will lead to also raising other wages that are subpar, if not below minimum?
Not much.
It won't have an impact on the middle class?
Not much. You see, 40 years ago when we had more unions and more people were in unions, then the union-negotiated wage did generally speaking, be a multiple of the minimum wage, so that when the minimum wage was raised, there was a kind of a ripple effect upward through unionized contracts. That's no longer the case because so few people are in unions and their pay is not affected by union contracts. So raising the minimum wage will help people certainly at the minimum wage push up wages that are close to the minimum wage, but probably have very little effect on middle-class wages.
Well, many of those union jobs were manufacturing jobs. Hasn't the American job market changed in the past 30 to 40 years with the decrease in manufacturing jobs?
Oh, yes. It's changed dramatically. As my example of Walmart being the largest employer now versus General Motors being the largest employer 40 years ago indicates. But that's also an argument for raising the minimum wage because most minimum wage jobs today are in retail or restaurant or hotel or hospital or surface transportation or child care or elder care. None of these kinds of jobs are in international competition. We don't have to worry about raising wages in ways that would reduce the number of jobs because the work would shift to Asia or to Mexico. It's not going to shift to Asia or Mexico because retail has got to be done here. Restaurant and hotel and hospital, these have to be done here. They're not going to be done by computers or by robots, most of them, because these jobs are also person-to-person jobs. Child care, elder care, hospital workers, these inevitably are going to be done, or most of them are going to be done by people. Raising their wages slightly so that they have a living wage is not going to force these companies or these institutions to move the work abroad or bring in robots.
Alejandro from Riverdale has written in to ask if you'd comment on the trend in how a lot of industries people are labeled independent contractors so they don't have to be paid benefits.
Well, this is a huge trend in American industry over the last 15 years. You see that businesses are shifting their employment to independent contractors, to temporary workers, to people who call themselves independents or independent workers, when in fact these are moves to shift the burden of risk from the company to the these independent employees, these contract employees. Companies would rather have not the fixed cost of employment that they have to deal with, including benefits and everything that goes with it. They would rather that their employment costs be what are called variable costs, that they can rise or fall with demand. They can actually minimize their costs as they want to make bigger profits. In fact, one of the reasons that we've seen bigger profits in companies, especially large companies, over the last 10 years, even with the Great Recession, coming out of the Great Recession over the last 5 years, corporate profits have risen dramatically because companies continue to shrink their payrolls. And part of shrinking payrolls is to move the employment out to independent contractors and to temps and contingent workers. Leonard, much of this, in my view, is illegal under the labor laws. These people who are doing exactly what they used to do as full-time employees, who are now labeled independent contractors or temporary workers, these people lose the protections of the United States labor laws, and that is illegal.
So should Eric Holder be going after these people?
I do believe so. I think the Labor Department should be going after them. To substitute full-time employment and employees with contract workers who do not have Social Security, do not have protections of occupational safety and health, do not have the minimum protections that we provide our full-time employees in terms of hours and working conditions, well, it seems to me that that is illegal. In fact, the labor laws make it illegal quite explicitly.
In the documentary Inequality for All, you say that 42% of kids born in poverty in the United States won't get out of it. Is it getting harder to move out of poverty?
Yes, the evidence suggests that it is getting harder for a number of reasons, because we are segregating more than ever before geographically in terms of where we live by our incomes. So poor people who used to be in a poor section of town are now in their own poor towns or their own poor cities, like Detroit. And when they are surrounded by other poor people, not only does their tax base that is used to finance local schools and sanitation and everything else suffer, so the schools are worse and they have fewer public amenities and public benefits and services, but also they're surrounded by people who have the same kinds of social problems that they have. Young people growing up in entire cities that are poor don't have models of successful upward mobility. They don't have models of people who are making it in America. And so it's harder for those young people to even envision a path to prosperity.
We don't have much time left, but I want to ask you about a report published in the New York Times last month that revealed that the American middle class is no longer the wealthiest middle class in the world, and that the poor here are poorer than the poor in other developed countries like Canada, Norway, England, Germany, and the Netherlands. At the same time, the United States remains the world's richest large country.
Well, we are the richest country in the world, presumably, we're going to continue to stay the richest country, but that doesn't mean that the typical American is the richest in the world any longer. I mean, what we're seeing is that as more and more income and wealth go to the top, the people at the top are doing better than ever. But the people in the middle and the people below them are not. And that's why that report, and there are similar reports, are showing that the citizens of other countries, particularly middle class and poor, are moving ahead of Americans, most Americans. And we face a choice, Leonard. I think it's a basic choice, and that is, do we want to stay on the current road in which, since the recovery started, 95% of all of the economic gains have gone to the top 1%, leaving the rest of us to split up the remaining 5%.
Well, what's your response to accusations that talking about inequality is class warfare? And we've even had more than one wealthy person saying that the kind of criticism they're receiving makes them feel like they are being persecuted in the way that Jews are persecuted in Germany.
Well, I think that's ridiculous talk. I think it would be irresponsible not to talk about what's happening to wages, to incomes, and to wealth in this country. But we mustn't vilify anybody. I mean, this is not because the rich are bad people. What we need to do is understand that the rules and laws we have that define and enforce our market. You know, markets are not in a state of nature. Markets are human creations. Those laws and rules have tilted the playing field now in favor of a very few people at the top and against many people who are at the bottom and in the middle. And we can change those rules and laws. In fact, it's our responsibility to do so. But unless we talk about this issue openly and candidly and frankly, we are not going to be able to do so.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He is currently Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Blum Center for Developing Economies. Thank you so much for being our guest today on this edition of Strapped, a look at poverty in America.
Well, thank you, Leonard.